Robert W. Lawson, Thomas Ed Mayor, Vander Ford Jr., Police Helen, L.T. Emmert, Ronald Coker, and Area Task Force Reality.
May proceed. May it please the court, Tracy Walker on behalf of Hyundai. There are a number of grounds upon which this court could reverse the trial court and order a new trial, including, for example, the improper impeachment of Hyundai's expert witnesses and the refusal of Hyundai's proper jury instructions. But Hyundai is entitled to reversal and final judgment based on the insufficiency of the evidence of an unreasonably dangerous defect. And the failure of proof arises primarily from two sources. First, the undisputed evidence, taken in a light most favorable to the Duncans, showed that the Tiburon, the vehicle at issue, met and exceeded the only objective standard applicable to occupant side impact protection, and that was the safety matter at issue in the case. While standards are only one piece of evidence for a jury to consider, under Turner v. Manning and Bartholomew v. Ford Motor Company, in the absence of any evidence to show that the standard at issue was inadequate, it is conclusive as to the issue of unreasonable dangerousness. Second, with respect to the expert witness testimony of Mr. Mann, the Duncan's expert witness, he testified to the methodology that he would have to have followed to find a defect in this vehicle. But he did not follow the methodology that he sponsored. He testified that the crossmember location where Hyundai placed the airbag sensor was not ideal because he determined that there was a superior location on the B pillar of the vehicle, which is a structural member on the side of the vehicle. But the location he proposed, he testified, was merely promising. And I would point the court to page 129 of the joint appendix. He pointed to a location that had not been studied by anyone, and he testified that it was promising, but he would have to test it to make sure that it would work. He didn't test it. He never tested it. He did no empirical analysis. Under this court's analysis in CNH America v. Smith, where an expert witness comes in and sponsors the methodology and says, this is what I would have to do, and then the witness does not do what the witness says they would have to do, the testimony should not come in to evidence. Hyundai was
So essentially you're saying that we require proof of an industry standard in addition to the expert opinion that that there was a defective design. Is that what you're saying? I mean, I know federal courts interpreting Virginia law have required that. Do you have any Virginia cases that actually say that?
Yes. It's a combination of two cases on the standards issue. In Bartholomew v. Ford Motor Company, the case involved the transmission. It was 224 Virginia 421. This court, it primarily involved the admissibility of expert testimony, but this court affirmed the admission of expert testimony in a case about a transmission design, and it was an injury case. The allegation was that the transmission had a defect that allowed a vehicle to move and someone was injured, and there was no applicable standard regarding the design of the transmission, and this court held that absent an established norm in the industry, it was a matter of opinion of trained experts what design was safe for its intended use. Here, there was a standard. So Bartholomew says, absent a standard, an expert can address it. But here, the plaintiff's, Duncan's expert, Mr. Mann, agreed that there was a standard, specifically Federal Motor Safety Standard 214, he agreed specifically addressed occupant protection and side impacts. And there's a typo in Hyundai's brief at page 9. We refer to the joint appendix at pages 1434 and 1435. It should be pages 1302 and 1303. But Mr. Mann testified that this standard 214 specifically applies to site impact protection. He testified that the standard is designed to protect against the unreasonable risk of injury, which is absolutely consistent with the Logan standard, and he agreed that the vehicle complied with the standard. Then you turn to the Turner v. Manning case, 216 Virginia 245, and in that case, the court, that case involved a hoist that was hooked up to a boom. It fell off and hit someone. The hoist was connected with an open-throated hook, and there was evidence that had a closed-throated hook been used, and they were available, the hoist would not have fallen and caused an injury, but the industry custom was to use the open-throated hook. And this court held there was evidence that the custom of the hoist industry to offer hoists without safety hooks. Such evidence of industry custom does not establish conclusively that due care was exercised. However, such custom or usage may be conclusive when there is no evidence to show that it was not reasonably safe. And in this case, the Duncans offered no evidence that standard 214 was in any way inadequate to provide for reasonable safety in site impact collisions.
Now, why wouldn't, if I understand your position, it's not as a matter of if there's an industry standard, this motion to strike is not granted as a matter of law. That's not what you're saying, is it, or is it?
I'm saying generally it is not, but in a case where they do not offer any evidence that the standard is inadequate, if they do not offer any evidence that the product somehow fails to meet the standard, if it's not a case such as Bartholomew where there is no standard, when the only evidence of an objective standard is that it applies to the risk at issue, that it provides for reasonable safety, then yes, the trial court should at that point have taken the issue away from the jury.
So if the matter, if the product satisfies the standard, then your position is the motion to strike should be granted even if the expert testifies that it's somehow defective?
It depends on his testimony. And if his testimony shows somehow that if there's something wrong with the product that effectively takes it outside the standard or that the standard is inadequate, I think that's precisely what the language of Turner says when it says that when there is no evidence to show that it was not reasonably safe. I think the word it in that sentence is referring back to the standard, not the product. Mm-hmm. If the standard is inadequate, then you proceed. And one of the amici cited a case from Texas, Kia v. Ruiz, I believe. Texas goes much further than Virginia by statute. They say that compliance with a standard creates a presumption of no defect. Virginia doesn't go that far. We are not urging that in any way. But if you read that case, it explains that the way you rebut that presumption is to show evidence that the standard is somehow inadequate. Here, no such evidence was offered. But, you know, I would go on to say, however, that Hyundai, well, let me say one more thing about the standards. The suggestion is made that Hyundai is arguing preemption, and I want to be perfectly clear that we're not seeking any kind of preemptive rule that would apply across the board. We are simply seeking to apply the Turner and Bartholomew rules to this particular fact pattern. This is not in any way seeking broad preemption, and if you apply Bartholomew, you're going to have cases where standards don't apply at all. You're going to have cases where there are manufacturing defects. So this is not any effort at all to seek a bright-line rule that would bar the courthouse doors to anyone. It's simply looking at this case. But even if you put the standards aside, if you put aside Mr. Mann's Ipsy-Dixit subjective testimony, he did, the words came out of his mouth that he believes this product is unreasonably dangerous. But if you look at the substance of his testimony, it actually demonstrates that the product was reasonably safe. He testified not only that the product complied with this federal standard that is designed for to guard against unreasonable danger in side impact collisions, exactly what happened here. He testified that the design is a good design when the airbag deploys. It gives good protection. He testified in the new car assessment program testing, which is done at a more severe level than the standards. He said in that testing, the vehicle actually does well at 1441 of the joint appendix. Gives good head protection. So he's acknowledging that this system that Hyundai voluntarily put in does provide a benefit, just not in this case. He quibbled with some calibration tests that Hyundai ran with a company called Bosch. An example of that, pages 13, 59, and 60 of the record, he said in one calibration the vehicle did pretty good. Just to give you an example of what he's quibbling about, if you read the testimony there, the airbag deployed in this computer-simulated calibration in 9 thousandths of a second. The target fire time was 12 thousandths of a second. In other words, it was 3 milliseconds fast. And he called that just pretty good. At 1379 through 80, there was one where it didn't meet Hyundai's own internal target. But even that one, the airbag still deployed as designed. But then he acknowledged that Hyundai ran a bunch of crash tests where they actually installed the sensor. And in every crash test, he acknowledged that the airbag deployed when it was supposed to. He couldn't point to a single one where it didn't. He said that the results were satisfactory in all of these crash tests. There was no evidence in this case, and I think the lack of evidence speaks louder, that occupants of Hyundai vehicles are at any higher risk in side impact collisions than occupants of any other vehicle. There was no evidence in this case that this young man would have been injured if he had been in any other vehicle that night. There was simply no evidence of that in this case. There was no evidence of any other industry custom or standard or test that was breached by Hyundai. Now, what Mann did say at one point, he says, if you're going to put this airbag in there, it's just got to work. You know, but that's an express warranty. There's no doubt that a company can go above and beyond the standard of merchantability in Virginia, the unreasonable, dangerous standard, and go to a higher level. But there is no obligation in Virginia to provide an injury-proof product. And the mere fact of this one injury without other evidence is not sufficient to sustain a verdict here.
Mr. Walker, is it your position that the standard is kind of a combination standard, that of the Bayliner case as well as the unreasonably dangerous, and when it left, knowingly it left the...
Your Honor, we wrestled with that because this court has repeatedly said that breach of warranty and negligence in a personal injury case are the same, it's unreasonable, dangerous, and we're not asking for a change in Virginia law. It was their burden to show that it was unreasonably dangerous. But how do you go about proving it? If you look at the difference between negligence and implied warranty, negligence focuses on conduct. So you say a manufacturer breached some duty of due care resulting in an unreasonably dangerous product. And then you say, well, implied warranty, they must have breached some standard of something resulting in an unreasonably dangerous product. And even the Duncans, in their opposition to Hyundai's petition, said there has to be a breach of some standard of safety. They said that at page 7 of their response. At the end of the day, I don't think it matters. I think Bayliner is consistent, ultimately, with Logan and the other Virginia cases that and Turner and Bartholomew, that you have to have something objective other than just hindsight opinion of an expert without more. And with regard to Mann, I really think I just want to read his quote. This was his deposition testimony. Hyundai moved in limine to exclude his testimony, and they brought this testimony to the attention of the trial court. The motion in limine is in the appendix, and this was called out in the motion. He selected a sensor location that was different than what Hyundai had studied. And at page 129, his location was 4 to 6 inches different than Hyundai's B-pillar location that it had studied. He said, that would be my first choice. Of course, I'd have to run tests to verify that that's just the right location. But based on their evidence of somewhat higher B-pillar location, that looks very promising. He says it looks promising. And at trial, he repeated this. He says you have to test it, you have to tune it, you have to make sure it works for a particular car. He testified that if you have a sensor on a location on a B-pillar for one car, it may not work on another car. And the reason is these are very precise, essentially computer accelerometers, and the acceleration signals depend on the structure of the vehicle. And it's got to be for that particular car.
Counsel, will you move to Asamovir 2 since you don't have much time left here?
I will move on. One point I want to make on the jury instructions, that instruction 21 is the instruction on the significance of complying with the standard. There's no dispute that it is a correct statement of Virginia law. There is no dispute that it was one of its primary theories of the case, that compliance with standards is evidence that this vehicle is reasonably safe and not defective. The argument is that this is an improper comment on the evidence. I would suggest one argument to do away with that. This instruction 21 is completely neutral. It is agnostic. If a plaintiff below had a case where there was some violation of some industry custom or some standard, this exact same instruction would work in that circumstance. This instruction is worded in such a way that it would work both ways equally, unlike the Owens Corning case cited by the Duncans in their response brief, where the defendant below sought an instruction that purported compliance constituted strong and substantial evidence of due care. And I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
You have 2 minutes and 50 seconds.
Good afternoon. I'm Steve Emmert, and along with Ari Casper and Ron Kovner, I represent a young man who was tragically injured in an automobile collision. Before I move on to the substantive arguments, it's important for me to mention what is not at issue in this appeal, what this case is not about. It is not about the quantum of damages. There's no assignment of error related to that. And Hyundai does not contend in this case that the substantial award is inappropriate for this level of brain injury. They just don't want to pay it. Also, proximate causation is not the subject of an assignment of error. Nowhere in there do they assign error to the issue of proximate causation. The same thing goes for the credentials of Mr. Mahon or any of the other experts that he relied upon in this case. None of these issues are contested in this appeal, and it's against that backdrop that we consider the other issues that we're deciding today. To give you an idea of where I propose to go, I will start with assignment one. I perceive the other issues being evidentiary. This is the primary battleground of whether there was substantial evidence in the record, or any evidence in the record that the jury could have accepted. I'll then turn to assignment two and then step back briefly to assignment one to discuss how they interplay. I'll mention assignments three and five briefly. I propose to leave the other issues to the briefs unless you have questions on them. On assignment one, I plan to start elsewhere, but Mr. Walker's argument suggests that I must bring this up to your attention immediately. His argument was that they demand an objective standard by which the manufacturer's conduct, by which its product can be measured. And I'm here to tell you there is no objective standard. No one gets an objective standard under our law for things like this. In vehicular cases, there's no absolute standard of liability when you run into the rear of another car. You're instead required to use ordinary care, the kind of thing that a jury is entitled to discern. In commercial litigation cases, when there's a breach of a contract, a seller has to make, or a buyer, I'm sorry, has to cover the sale within a commercially reasonable period. We don't tell them 10 days or 30 days. Under none of these circumstances is there a formal standard. The treatise that I mentioned to you that I had just found, because it just arrived from the law library.
Mr. Emmert, the language of Ford Motor is absent an established norm in the industry. Why isn't the Fair Motor Vehicle Standard, safety standard, an established norm in the industry?
Because, first of all, this court has held otherwise in all the other cases that involve personal injuries. The burden is to prove that it's unreasonably dangerous, not that it failed to meet a standard. If it were just a matter of meeting standard, then FMVSS would be the issue, and that would be all that we had. Because those standards do apply to vehicles, that every vehicle case that was brought against a manufacturer would be governed by that. And we know that's not the case.
What does Ford Motor mean when it uses that language? How do you interpret that?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. My sense is that what it says, when there is an existing standard, that's what governs the case. But this standard doesn't apply to cover the situation of whether a sensor system placed in a wrong location makes the vehicle unsafe. FMVSS, by the way, assumes that the airbag is going to go off. I don't think that deals with the location of the sensor. It deals with the functioning of airbag systems,
How
not
can
the
you
placement
say
of the sensor.
It's wrong location unless you have a standard or expert testimony.
The standard is, well, expert testimony is the answer to it. The standard is whether it's unreasonably safe. It's important for me to mention here that we didn't have to prove that they didn't put it in the perfect location. And I will readily say they didn't have to put it in the perfect location. That's what Mr. Mayne was talking about by saying I probably would have put it 4 or 6 inches away. They just have to put it in a location that doesn't render the vehicle unreasonably dangerous. And they tucked it under the driver's seat, well inboard from the side of the vehicle.
I'm sorry. You're saying the Fair Motor Vehicle Standard is not a standard. It's not a norm by which we can compare anything.
I think that's accurate to say. The federal motor vehicle safety standards are designed to be self-certifications by the manufacturers. The federal government doesn't test these cars. They set out a set of standards and say, tell us that you've met these, and then you can say you've met FMVSS. And Hyundai did that with this. The federal government didn't conduct these crash tests. Hyundai did.
If there is no norm, and I guess this is just what Justice Mims asked, if there is no norm, then how would you ever determine whether something is unreasonably safe? What are you comparing it against?
For the answer to that, I am going to turn to the treatise that I identified, the Owen and Davis treatise, because that has the answer. It's on page 458. The passage is brief, and I'll read it. It's about 25 seconds. The law allocates responsibility for product safety, first, to manufacturers to make their products reasonably safe, and so conforming to the safety obligations of both the regulators and the courts. Second, to governmental regulators to set minimum safety standards, and finally to the courts to test a manufacturer's safety decision against generally applicable safety standards based on balance, reason, and fairness. That's what we trust the juries to do, and you do have to have expert testimony in these cases. There's no question about that, and we adduced it. And the bottom line with Jeff Mahon's testimony was he opined in two separate locations this failure to locate the sensor properly made the vehicle unreasonably dangerous. I want to make sure that I phrased that correctly. I'm not saying that the sensor was unreasonably dangerous because Hyundai isn't warranting a sensor. It's warranting a car. And that, in his view, made the car unreasonably dangerous.
I'm having the same problem that the circuit court judge had. If this vehicle without an airbag, and according to your testimony, your expert's testimony, as I understand it, with the airbag, passed the FMVSS standards, with or without the airbag. So let's take without the airbag first, it passed the standards. How could adding an airbag, even if we accept that the sensor was in the wrong place, possibly make it unreasonably dangerous?
If you assume that FMVSS is conclusive, then the judge would be right to be wondering about that. But it's not, as the statute and all the case law and the treatises say. But my best answer to that, I'll borrow from Abraham Lincoln.
Let's assume it's not conclusive. Let's assume it sets the floor beyond this.
Okay. All the more reason
that's
for me to
use this.
That's
the norm. That's the standard. Right. That's the standard.
I'll answer your question by using the Lincoln idea that I had. In the Civil War, he was meeting with some of his generals who were squabbling among themselves, and he interrupted in order to end it by saying, if you call a tail a leg, how many legs does a horse have? And one of the generals answered, well, five. And Lincoln shook his head and smiled and said, no, calling a tail a leg doesn't make it a leg. That's the same mistake that they're making and that the judge is having trouble with. If you call a Hyundai safe and then add an airbag to it, isn't it still safe? But the problem is this Hyundai was never safe because the airbag system, where they put it, was not in a proper location for the sensor to pick it up.
If it didn't have an airbag, what would your argument be?
That would be an imaginary car, as we know, since that didn't exist. But I would say
There were no cars in that model year that didn't have side airbags?
They manufactured all the vehicles in that model year with airbags.
Okay.
There was no such car. But assuming for the moment that you still want an answer to that, and I will give it to you, the answer is I would argue that it's unsafe. And the answer to that is because of Mr. Mahon's testimony that, based on their testing, at 18 miles an hour, absolutely they want a bag. That's a quote of his testimony. Absolutely they want a bag. That means that if they know that at 18 miles an hour some side protection is necessary and they elect to build a car without an airbag system, then yes, it's unreasonably dangerous because they know. They've done the testing and they've concluded on their own terms that they need an airbag.
Well, Mr. Emmert, let me ask you a question. Your expert did testify and state in a number of places that, under his opinion, it was unreasonably dangerous where the airbag was, the sensor was,
yes,
put it that way. And yet, as opposing counsel has pointed out, he never said why. I mean, he relied on Hyundai's test. He did no testing. He didn't. And the only question, I guess, was that at a certain speed, perhaps this airbag, the speed was too low to inflate the airbag, or perhaps because of the way the car was involved in an accident, the airbag wouldn't go off. But he had no tests or anything that he did that showed that it was unsafe.
Actually, he did conduct a crash severity analysis, which was his own testing and analysis of it. So that's not true to say that he didn't do anything. But the objection that Hyundai has is that it's no fair that he's using our data against us. He absolutely can use their data, their testing, and their results. And he walked the jury through the process of seeing this is how they conduct the tests. They got to watch the films of the poll test being conducted. He got to show them their charts and their data and walk them through that, saying this is what this means. This is how, where you get a trigger point, you need to have an airbag at this point. He walked them through the engineering of the sensor systems. He taught the jury airbags and airbag sensors. And under those circumstances, he wasn't required to do what I guess they're suggesting, which is that a plaintiff in our circumstance has a duty to go out and design and build a new car that has an airbag in a particular place, build several models of it, and start crashing it. That would be a wonderful boon for the manufacturing industry because no plaintiff could afford to do that. But when they have the numbers, and our expert relies upon the numbers and explains in terms of visual and auditory testimony why this means there has to be an airbag, and then concludes, at 18 miles an hour, absolutely they want a bag. The jury's entitled to believe that.
Well, it's not that they have a bag, it's where the sensor was. That's the question, not that they have
Understood.
A bag.
Understood. And he testified in a couple of places, at 1396 and 1408 of the appendix, that if the sensor was located on the B pillar, then you would have a bag. There are two places where he clearly says that. And the B pillar is the proper location. I'm not going to quibble over 3 or 4 inches because
right
I don't need
point,
the perfect.
Mr. Emmert, excuse me. The B pillar is the best place to put the sensor. What data did he use, what scientific data, testing data did he use to justify that other than just his own ipsy-dixit, as the appellant says?
That testimony, I'm not going to tell you a specific page because it's laid out over the course of 100-plus pages of direct, but he does say in there that he sees where Hyundai is testing it at various locations, and at the B-pillar, you get a clear, robust signal. Robust is a term of art for those scientists, but it means it comes through clearly. And that means, in his view, you would get an airbag signal. The sensor would pick it up, and the bag would deploy if it were located on the B-pillar. You probably noted that he said, if I were designing for this crash, I would put it on the sill, which is about down by your kneecap. But he's designing for all crashes. That's page 1402, by the way.
Now, was he basing that on the 1999 tests?
Yes, sir. Yes, that's correct.
I thought his testimony was that you could not build a car that would render one safe in all crashes. There's no place you could put the sensor that would make it safe in all crashes.
I don't specifically recall that, but I think it's probably correct. I don't recall that he indicated that, but it would be difficult for me to imagine a car that would be sufficient to resist every single crash.
Okay, let me ask another question. He didn't run any tests on the particulars of this particular accident, no one did. But Hyundai ran a test with a 10-inch pole with the sensor where it was. Your expert is saying with this 30-inch tree, I believe it was, it's faulty because it didn't trigger. Without running a test, how do we know that it's faulty in this situation when the test that was run was on a 10-inch pole?
Because you can calculate it from the statistics based upon the width of the tree, compare it with the size of the pole that they did, and it's mathematically calculated. He walks the jury through that. It's not just a matter of Ipse Dixit. He actually goes through all this in the direct examination that Hyundai chooses not to see in this case. I want to mention a couple of other things before I move on to assignment three, or at least one anyway. All of your cases, all of the decisions, have recognized the divide between breach of warranty cases that arise from disappointed economic expectations and those that produce personal injuries. In the disappointed economic expectation cases, that's where you require the plaintiff to prove a standard of merchantability. But in all of the personal injury cases, including Logan, I went back and checked, and I was mistaken at the petition stage. In Logan, although the word standard of safety occurs, that's not what a plaintiff has to prove. On page 428 of the Logan opinion, this court set out exactly what a plaintiff has to prove, and it's the same two factors: unreasonably dangerous at the time it left the manufacturer's hands. Let me turn to assignment three, if I may.
May I ask you a question on the implied warranty that's described in 8.2-314?
Yes, ma'am.
Does that apply here to a personal injury action?
I don't think it's the same kind of warranty, because that is the UCC version of an implied warranty of merchantability, and this is a personal injury claim. Now, the law imposes upon the manufacturer a specific duty to ensure that its product is not unreasonably dangerous, and that governs the commercial law claims, such as Bayliner, that kind of thing.
That was the language that was used in the complaint in this case.
I understand that. But I don't think that it governs the standard that the jury had to evaluate, and the jury was instructed correctly about the two things that we had to prove. I keep mentioning two, and I should mention the second of those really isn't at issue here. Hyundai doesn't contend that there was any alteration of the vehicle. That was the condition of the car when it left the lot. But in this case, what we had to prove, and what we've always maintained we had to prove, was that it was unreasonably dangerous. And we did that. Our evidence met that standard. With that evidence, assignment one thereby falls necessarily, because under 8.01680, the only way they can win is if there's no evidence to support it, and Mahon clearly makes that connection. I do want to move to assignment three briefly. And what I want to do for here, in order to conclusively, I think, end any concern about this, is invite the court's attention to volume three of the appendix on page 1488. I'll read through for those of you who may not have it handy. 1488 is where, in direct examination or cross examination, Mr. Casper is talking to the first defense witness.
Excuse me, what was the page?
1488 of the appendix. It's volume three. Mr. Casper is beginning to ask questions of the first defense expert, Mr. Germain, and he goes into the question where he's been involved in other incidents with Chevron, and there's an objection. There's two pages of colloquy here in which the judge analyzes what the nature of the objection is, and at the bottom of page 1489, the judge says, why can't he ask that? Asking for a specific objection. At the top of page 490, here's the answer, and this is the only answer they gave. Again, Your Honor, I'm just trying to make sure he's not going any further than it's going. That's all I was trying to do. That's a specific request for a specific objection, and he didn't get one. After that, on the following two pages, 1490 and 91, you have the examination between Mr. Casper and the witness, in which the information about the other crash and a death came out. There's no objection. Hyundai doesn't speak up. They don't stand and ask for a cautionary instruction. They sit mute and elect to roll the dice on what the jury has to say. That information is now before the jury. And now in this case, they're asking you to find fault with the same information coming in with regard to Mr. Pearson. Now, Mr. Walker and I can disagree on the specificity of the objection with regard to Mr. Pearson a little later in the appendix. But beyond question, this evidence is in the record. The jury has it, and it's the identical information. If they had an objection to it and wanted to limit its use, now is the time when you should ask the judge, please give them a limiting instruction showing that they can't accept this for the truth of the matter asserted. Instead, they decided to wait to see what the jury did. That's conclusive, I think, in this case. But this evidence was not offered to prove causation, which was the issue in Funkhauser. This is merely a fresh recollection. Assignment 5 deals with instructions, and I'll just mention a couple of them because I believe that numbers 16 and 20 have effectively been abandoned. And number 19 deals with misuse, and they continue to insist they should have had a misuse instruction, at least on brief. And this is a matter where the trial judge made a specific finding. It just doesn't apply to the facts of this case. Two things are worth mentioning here. The first is that the testimony in the case unambiguously indicated that after having passed another car, Mr. Duncan, quote, got back into his lane and was under control. That's page 1483 of the appendix. It was from the testimony from Mr. Sumner, one of the other gentlemen who was there that night. And so that's why the judge found that it doesn't apply. There's no evidence of misuse. And again, proximate causation is not a question here. But in this case, a defense is available if there is unforeseeable misuse. You'll see throughout Hyundai's arguments here, they keep harping on this had to be evidence of misuse. Driving 35 to 40 in a 35 zone is
Mr.
evidence
Emmert,
of misuse.
Will you address 21, instruction 21?
Certainly. That's the importance of FMVSS. And again, I would mention the treatise that I gave you before, the Owen and Davis treatise, that lists from pages 454 through 456, that is merely, in its words, a piece of the evidentiary puzzle. It's entirely appropriate for the jury to hear about those standards, but it's entirely wrong for a Virginia trial judge, as contrasted with federal court, to pick out an individual item of information or individual bit of evidence and say to the jury, you should consider this evidence in particular when reaching your verdict. We don't allow judges to do that. That's comment on the evidence, and you have never, never countenanced that in a trial court. Under these circumstances, there's no basis for the giving of this instruction. Now, before I leave, I want to mention one thing that seems to be the subtext of Hyundai's arguments, and it's clearly the text of the amici's arguments, and that's its suggestion that the court should reverse in interest of public policy, because it's sort of a risk-reward analysis. Reward's not the right word, but I think you know what I mean. But they're saying that we should encourage manufacturers in this way. The first response is the simplest, and that's that they're making the argument on the wrong side of Ninth Street. It's the exclusive prerogative of the General Assembly to set public policy, and we don't have that. But more fundamentally, these issues have been considered and rejected across America. The part of the Owen and Davis treatise that I read on page 458 indicates these are matters that we have regulations, we have courts to enforce what becomes reasonable in terms of what the jury finds. The jury finds that it's unreasonably dangerous, then that's the measure of liability. Manufacturers don't occupy a privileged position here. They're just as liable as any other defendant for their unreasonably dangerous products. Otherwise, we will be giving lie to John Adams' observation that we are a country of laws, not of men.
If you go back and look at what both parties cited to in the joint appendix, most of it comes down to Mr. Mann. And I would suggest to you that his testimony was absolutely inadmissible. He provided the veneer of a foundation. He testified at great length about how airbag systems worked. He went into detail about what Hyundai did in its analysis. But when you get down to what he based his opinion on, there just wasn't anything there. And I just want to point to a couple of parts of the record. At pages 1409 and 1410, he explained that not only do inches matter when you're picking a sensor location, but increments of less than an inch matter. And then we get to 1448 and 1449, and then back to his deposition at 128 and 129. He picked a location 4 to 6 inches away from anywhere that anyone had ever studied. And he said, it looks promising, I would have to test it. He never did. Hyundai couldn't put a vehicle out on the road by just having an engineer give his after-the-fact engineering judgment. And Mr. Mann should not have been permitted to come in without doing anything. He didn't, and it doesn't bar plaintiffs from coming into the court. Mr. Mann explained that much of this analysis can now be done on a computer with commercially available computer programs. We're not saying they had to go spend hundreds of thousands of dollars crashing vehicles. He did nothing. He made it look like he did a lot by just talking about what Hyundai did, but he did nothing to support his particular opinion, and that was the cornerstone of their entire case, that that location was better. Finally, with regard to the standards, this court, in a personal injury action, Bartholomew v. Ford Motor Company was a personal injury product liability action, and this court has said that standards do matter. We can't just brush them aside. They have significance. And there was no evidence here that the vehicle didn't comply. The evidence from the Duncans was that it did comply. Whether it was self-certified or not, the evidence came from the Duncans that this vehicle complied with a standard designed to ensure that it was reasonably safe with or without an airbag. They didn't put any without airbags on the road, but the evidence, Justice Mims, was that they tested it without the airbag system and it still complied. Thank you for your time.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.